Come on.
Well, wait, you know French too.
That's true. Yeah, So you're the case study. So we're going to talk about your situation, what's going on. What Larry asked me to do is sort of, you know, as we like to do is just talk about a lot of the stuff that what is issues around and kind of focusing it on executive and board compensation because they're kind of related to each other. So what we have in here, I'm going to go through a few minutes. I'm going to go through some data. There's always like data. We bring data to the party and hopefully some insights. But what's interesting in the data when you look at this, there are some patterns that we see that pop out, and so it's as benchmarks. So you can use it. You know, I was thinking about like several of you are coaching executives, or you are working on boards, and you need like a quick frame of reference. Like, what's the bonus look like for a CFO, and how's it compared to a CEO? What's the pay of a CEO versus a CFO? You know, what does equity look like? I hear it's all going to restricted stock. Well, what's that really look like? So I want to give you some factoids to put in your head, and you can use it. And if you like what you say, Susan and I are here to work with you and our team. We have a group of people, about six of us, and we've been a boutique firm, and we love focusing and working really close to our clients and developing good solutions that work and endure, and we have fun and all make money at the same time. So that's a little bit about Wilson Group. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the background stuff and then some trends issues. Susan's going to pick up and talk about what we're seeing as trends, and obviously what your experience and you're seeing in trends. And then we got some other things we'll close out. We'll see how we go in terms of how we think about this. So this is all, so we work with all this. Before, I'm going to talk a little bit about context in terms of the big picture of where we are. You know, here's a couple of interesting things. We all know the market for talent is really tight. And we're getting which is almost historically low unemployment. A lot of reasons why. As I said, like the average unemployment from 1948 to 2019 is 55.8%. Right now, we're actually below around 4% or 3.9%, and that number is, some say, that a little different. And the national is ranged from 10.8 to 2.5. So if you love to sort of talk about, you know, ranges, we're in that kind of middle. And in Massachusetts is 3.3. So those are national numbers, the one I started. So Massachusetts in particular is in a tight labor market. Are you finding that? Are you having, in your companies that your people you work with, are they having trouble finding people, or is it a buyer's market, seller's market?
It's a strange situation because we do get, when we are looking for profile, we do get resumes and so
right,
on.
Right.
But a large number of them are just not the right fit with
right.
The,
exactly.
The job. And on the other ones, things go fast.
Yeah.
Things go super fast. I mean, if you don't move fast with these people, you know, 1 week, 2 weeks later, you are gone already.
Right.
So you it's not like you don't find anyone, but if you are very picky, so think, okay, this
right.
one may be good, but I'm going to get him a couple of, a series of interviews because I really want to make sure that I can validate different aspects of his profile and so on. They take so much time that they go away.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And then you don't
know. I think it's a great point.
I've been doing a lot of work with growing companies in the Midwest, and their largest major constraint to growth is manpower.
People, yeah.
They cannot find people.
Right, right.
And that's just killing them in terms of access to any kind of resource that
right.
they need at every level of the company.
Right. So it's being pervasive, and there are certain pockets that come and go, as we all know. But I think in general, this is probably one of the strongest markets we've had in a long time. But every organization has to be responsible. The one thing I found fascinating, reading in preparing for this meeting today, the millennials this year will now exceed the number of boomers that are in the market.
Working.
Mm-hmm.
There are. Talk about boomers for a second. There are, and back to one of your examples, there are 10,000 people a day turning 65. And this will go on for 15 years.
In the U.S.?
In the U.S. So we are seeing the baby boom generation. Now, people aren't necessarily retiring at 65. They're working until 70, some 75, some even beyond that. and not always because they have to, sometimes they want to, some people they have to. But it is a dynamic still around the changes in the demographics, at the, particularly at the executive levels. Because, I mean, there are, you know, people all over in organizations. But I find it really interesting that the millennials now will soon be exceeding. Well, what does that mean? That means that if you think about what the workforce now wants, what do they want from the employment that they're looking at? It's no, we come up from the mindset of boomers type of framework or X-gen type of frameworks, and it's really about a millennial. And there's a lot of studies now about what millennials want in their workplace, and it's oftentimes they don't want to be bricklayers, they want to be cathedral builders. So it's appealing to people's sense of mission, sense of collaboration, sense of transparency. Those are the demands that they don't put up with much crap in terms of leadership and everything else. Yeah.
The 1 year MBA students are typically younger. Some of them have just graduated a year or two ago and they went straight in. There's a lot of that these days. But Generation Z, the younger generation, even more so in terms of being socially driven, what's the mission of your company, social responsibility, all that stuff, all the way through the supply chain. It's interesting discussions and the questions that folks are asking.
Right.
And in this particular program that I'm part of, it's fall teaching, spring group projects, summer internships, and they're starting to see what the world is like, and it's putting them in an interesting situation in my conversation, because now they're having to choose with, I have my ideal job where I want to go, and then the reality of what's out there in the marketplace, because many companies are not as mission-driven, socially responsible as the younger people would like, and it's creating a lot of angst for them because they feel like, okay, I have to give up part of what I want in order to pay for my way in the world,
right.
And that's an even more so than the millennials are finding with those folks.
That's a great point. So it's a real dynamics around how we think about
it.
Sorry?
It's an aha moment.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, it is. It is. By the way, I don't know about you, but I remember having that aha moment. So when I was about 25, 28, all of a sudden you realize that, oh, crap, this is what I have to work for a living. there's a lot of that. It's another technical term. I talk a lot of tech terms.
Keeping up with you.
Okay, go ahead.
I'm the only one.
That's good. The economy, what's happening in the economy? What's interesting, if you look at Q2 of last year, it grew at 4.2, Q3, 3.4, Q4, 2.6. The feds generally say that an ideal is between 2 and 3% of GDP growth. What's going to happen in 2019? What are we seeing? Are you seeing slowing down? We had, 50,000 people employed last month, you know, whatever. Usually it's 180 or 200,000. So are you seeing slowdowns, or are you still seeing it ramping in different places?
I'm still seeing it ramping.
Yeah.
I look at my customer base, which is Canada.
Can you speak a little louder?
Yeah.
Oh, I can.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Talk to them. Talk to him.
I didn't want to yell in his face.
That's okay.
So
people will yell at me all the time.
My customer base is the Americans. And the nature of the beast is the construction market. If, you know, for fire systems, for example, if there's construction, then, you know, you need more fire systems. And back in 2007, 2008, the economy kind of tanked, the business declined because it wasn't as much building, and money was tight. When money loosens up, it's either expanding buildings. So my business kind of falls that. When I look at my customers, they're growing. And I also see when they, for example, look ahead at jobs, look ahead at opportunities. So we'll see the forecasts and the plans. And they're skyrocketing, and they're not slowing down, and they're projected out 2 years. So for me, from real-world experience, it's pretty steep. Okay. That's climbing.
Other soft spots? So. Yeah.
You're asking for soft spots?
Yeah, or whatever you want to say.
Well, I was going to point out that in the robotic world, you can't find enough engineers.
Right. That's what's limiting your growth.
And there's mechanical engineers, electrical engineers, and roboticist engineers.
Right.
And we're falling behind China and South Korea. Like, South Korea is 20 times more than we do, produce more than we do each year. So we're losing ground as we sit here. I am also seeing, my daughter went into tech sales for a company called LogMeIn, some of you may know it. And there's people coming in with music degrees that are moving into sales and coming in from other industries. Got to be soft in the music area, I would imagine. So mm-hmm. I don't know what was spent in the first 4 years of their college, but now they're finding work in other areas. It's satisfying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, people, I think, are looking not at the superficial nature of what you majored in, but what are your competencies. But they look for people who have the kind of interpersonal relationships or data analysis or whatever, kind of things that are really looking below the surface in terms of what the talent is to deal with that. And so there's certain markets where we're you know, it seems like a little, if we talk about a recession, do you think we're going to get a recession this year?
Yeah.
I think this.
You do?
So yeah. one of my
samples. Just to, before we change conversation, I'd like to support your point, Tom, about the hazards of stereotyping.
Right.
Candidate.
Yeah.
I worked at Goldman Sachs for a number of years. I had a large team of analysts working for me. The absolute head and shoulders best analyst that ever worked for me was a religion major.
Wow.
So get to know the person.
Yeah. That's great.
But I think the other part of it, and you touched on it, is what companies have recognized that if you have. If people have good critical thinking skills,
right.
Everything else falls into place.
Right.
And
right.
Part of the challenge of some of the educational systems is they don't teach critical thinking.
Right.
And so those people are at a disadvantage around being able to say it's a wide variety of competencies.
Right.
And so how do you focus on that?
That's
and then
point.
You can hire the music major and the religion major and everything else because they've got the ability to think analytically.
Well, just to be a little pejorative, and then we can get back on track. I think the talent acquisition process is so superficial. It's kind of a volume operation. It's pushed significantly toward the quantitative end because of the difficulty of establishing the kind of talents and traits you're talking about that most organizations don't even try anymore. And it's almost like throwing darts at a board in the dark through this talent acquisition process, even when you hire professional specialist firms to help you with it or do it for you.
When you say you don't try anymore, are you saying that they don't try to find their own talent organization?
No, they don't try to understand the kind of qualities that she's talking about in a young candidate. You know, for a senior level officer, absolutely. A lot of resources are dedicated to do that. But for entry and lower level positions where those qualities are just as important as they are in the C-suite, it's so difficult and problematic because of potential litigation risks that a lot of it just isn't done anymore.
So listen, before we could do the whole session on the global talent issue, because I do want to kind of bring us back to our
conversation.
But if there's something, a key point, I don't want to stop.
I was just going to say, to your point, there's some fascinating work being done now in AI around selection, where they look at all kinds of unobtrusive and discrete metrics around a person's background to put it together.
Right.
In a way that no human really can, to say this person has those kind of skills, which are much more abstract to look for in a regular resume.
So there's a lot happening around
right.
the talent and the talent, identification and development, and et cetera. A couple of key points on this slide. We'll talk a little bit about the tariffs, but I'm going to skip over that. And the last point about really is what's interesting as the baby boomers and the people in that's not just at the executive levels, it's people who have institutional knowledge about how to run a machine shop or whatever it might be. Those people are retiring. There is massive risks to businesses around this talent drain. And AARP did a study to look at what is your preference. You're saying, do you go 65 miles an hour until you're 65 and then you drop? No, 85% of people said, no, I want to ramp down. Most organizations and systems are set up to be a cliff. And yet people want a ramp. And so what we're seeing is companies are trying to think through what's the transition process you want to look at. And it changes if you're on a ramp out in terms of how you relate to people who now have your job, and to if they're the leaders. And particularly it's insensitive and in leadership roles. So we'll spend some time talking to some about that.
Can I ask
please?
You, when you said we'll skip over tariffs, when you start talking about total comp, will you look at the, could you look at those industries where tariffs are impacting them in terms of the impact on margins and ultimately on comp?
We can.
Okay.
Yeah, we need to talk a little bit about it because it's an interesting complex topic if you're saying that, but because there's it's not a straight line there.
Right.
So just as a conceptual framing, we frequently use this little box as a way to sort of look at total compensation, total rewards, and the key parts of this is if the left hand side is what we sometimes call foundation elements of compensation, your salary, your benefits. So I'm going to look at an offer from you. I want to know what my salary is. I know what your benefits are. They're interested in that from the standpoint of foundations. It also is the way in which you think about it. You compete with the other people in the outside market for people who are interested in that sort of foundation. The right-hand side is more performance-based. It's incentives, it's bonuses, it's equity awards, et cetera. It's also things like recognition, work. What's the impact of work? Do I get recognized for my performance? Do people know who I am? Are there opportunities to develop and grow in this organization if I perform well? All those kinds of things. And so the total picture is involved in all these. The way we sometimes use this as we talk through a philosophy with a company is where you put your money, where do you put your energy, where do you put your, what are you missing in terms of an opportunity to really get the kind of people, retain the kind of people you're really looking for. And we think about it in terms of some of these quadrants, and every consultant has their own quadrants. And there's another one. And so we use this sometimes as a dialogue to make sure we've covered the bases when you think about what total rewards and what total environments looks like. Often the question is, how much? So the next page, let me show you, there's a lot on this page. And so this takes a little bit of walking through it. So this is data. It's median data only. So it's not the 75th and 25th percentile. It's from public companies. So I pull the data from proxies. So, and it's the most recent proxies, and it's New England companies. And then what we did was we looked at a sample set of those. We looked at all New England companies. We broke it by three types of sizes for CEO job only. Small companies, mid-market companies, large companies. You'll see what the revenue ranges are. And then some cuts by some different industries. So that's what is on the, that's what the rows are. We look at the number of companies that are in that data set and the average revenues or the median revenues for that set. So this represents 243 New England companies that are publicly traded with an average annual revenues of $270 million. They pay their CEO $575,000. They also give that executive $490,000 on an average bonus, which is 85% of salary. And at the total, it's a, you know, because you're dealing, you're not adding across, you're adding, you know, by different data sets, about $950,000 in cash compensation, which, by the way, is 0.4% of the revenues. This goes a little bit to your question about you can't get at margins, but you can get at revenues. So as is a 0.4% of revenues. One second, let me finish. Well, go ahead. Yeah, Mike.
Well, I was just curious. The really interesting thing to me about this chart is the table of the you know, the size profile of the employer, and that column called annual bonus as a percent of salary going from 58 to 110.
Yes.
The question I ask myself is, why aren't the small and middle-sized companies also structuring compensation for those folks the same way? I come from a business where the variable compensation was always a multiple of your base. You didn't get a big base.
Right.
You were there to perform.
Right. Going back to the page we saw before. Yeah, philosophically, small base, high incentive. Startup companies, small base, forget about bonus, equity. Right? And that, if you think of that as startup kind of, so you're playing on the deal.
It gives you an equity mentality for working in a
firm. Exactly. Well, who knows why? I'm sure this has been evolving. Yeah, go ahead.
Can your content private versus public?
These are all public companies.
Understood.
Okay.
Where do you see the data?
Good question. Well, you know, we've been studying some, because we have a lot of private companies and our clients of ours, and maybe we'll help respond to that. But one thought is that this is a reference point because a lot of people who are coming out of CEOs have been in public companies, and they are paid like this. that come to a private company, if it's family-owned business, or is it a family that is on a trajectory to an IPO, is it, or at ready for acquisition, what's this context for that? Also drives a lot of the amounts. It's also the we find that cash is not, you know, is more related to the financials of the business than equity. And equity, sometimes you see it, so usually a lot more conservative, because in a private company, if it's not going public, the equity is funded by the company itself. So they're a little more constrained than they would in a public company. But Susan, what would you think?
Yeah, I would say, you know, it's hard to get some of that private company data. I'm sure you all have your companies participating in surveys. That's one of the issues, is trying to find that. But I agree that we have and it depends on the industry, we do see some consistencies between public and private. But as we go smaller companies are definitely going to have, and depending again on the industry, are going to have smaller bonus opportunities. It also speaks to how sophisticated their process is for determining payouts. I love the example of investments there, where it's so clear how to make those payouts. But when you have a small private company where they don't really want to invest in how they tie payouts to their success, then it becomes a little tougher.
Do you see enough portfolio companies that you can give us a profile of those versus private and public?
Portfolio meaning, I mean,
private equity.
You mean like what?
Private equity firm? Smaller, I think.
Yeah, but they tend smaller. There's a couple things. There's a bit about the context that we find in private equity firms, because some private equity firms are taking a long-term view, they're trying to put it together, they want the company to run basically independent. There's a philosophy around private equity where they're like long-term investors, if you will. Others are to clean it up, fix it up, shape it up, match it with another company. They're trying to bolt some things together, and they're making a lot of changes in those kind of organizations, in which case they oftentimes change out the CEO or the CFO or whatever. So it's a more active kind of a private equity kind of firm. So we often see that they really like equity, the private equity firm, to tie bonuses and lower on the bonus, lower on the salaries. They do what you got to do for one thing about some of my clients who have been private equity firms. You sort of do what you got to do for cash, but cash is always really critical, and more you give to executives, the less you have for the business, and so therefore we'll play equity. So it's hard for me to draw a conclusion. I've seen so many different kind of firms. It's more about the philosophy that they go, and I look at try to make sure that the and what's kind of what we do, that the compensation plan is in alignment with your philosophy. And so if you're really trying to drive this business forward, you want growth, you want whatever else, then you change it. A quick example, I was asked one time to design a plan for CEO of a private company. And so it was owned by a family, but they were thinking about taking it public and weren't sure what they wanted to do with it, but we were talking a lot about the CEO. So I said, well, who is this person you're trying to hire? This person a hired gun, or is it an adopted son or daughter? How you answer that question, I'll tell you how to design a plan. And is that, it's guessing at that fundamental to really understand, which lands up, I'm gonna segue this into the other part. The third leg here on the equity, which is interesting here, is that what this is showing is 46% of the equity, it's basically $1 million in equity, $1.5 million, if you will, total equity. But they may say like 46% of it is options and 54% of it is in restricted stock or RSUs or whatever. And what we're finding is that there's clearly a run towards the restricted stock for two reasons. One is you use less equity to deliver the same amount of value. If I'm gonna give you $1 million, if I give you $1 million worth of stock, it's one thing. If I give you $1 million worth of options, I have to give you a lot of shares, a lot of options to equal that $1 million, which you're likely to earn that. Second reason is in 2008, a lot of people saw their equity go in the toilet. Now, that it's kind of now history for people, but there's some people still remember that when their options went way underwater, and it took a long time. They didn't think about the I'll call it dollar cost averaging of getting awards when the stock was really low. Now it's back up and higher, and they made a lot of money on that deal. But at the time, it scared people a lot, and at that point, there was a clear movement towards equity. But there's a lot of pressure from the investor groups to limit the amount of overhang, to limit the amount of equity that you use in your executives. So companies tend to go towards restricted stock, and people tend to like, I find, restricted stock more than like options, unless they are at a high growth, high startup, you know, where this is going to go, you know, it's going to go from 25-50 cents a share to $30 a share. They give me options any day, because it's like getting founder stock.
And for public companies, the institutional investor groups that are saying that they don't think stock options are performance based.
Right. Right.
So they're going with full stock.
Yeah.
That is performance.
Which to build on what Susan just said is that what we see when people lay out options or restricted stock, they will put options vesting on time. But if I'm gave you a bonus, I'm going to give you a restricted share, I want you to earn that. So they'll tend to put performance factors, not time related, some hurdles to do a restricted stock. So that also, boards tend to like that, shareholders tend to like that performance orientation rather than an option. Options are harder to really trigger, but that's sort of the name of the game of what we're saying. And then what we also found is that, you know, it's kind of interesting, the CEOs in this kind of case was total cash all in, total comp all in was about 1% of revenues. So, you know, and yet that's different for industries and different by sizes and stuff like that. So highlights, bonuses are going from 60 to 80%, and we're starting to see in larger companies, 100% of salary bonuses. We're seeing long-term incentives moving towards RSUs. We're seeing LTI. If you look at this, do the math here, it's the value of the equity is about 2 to 3 times their salary, and total direct comp is usually 1 to 3% of revenues. So good cocktail talk. Now, CFOs. Ellie, you might be interested in this. The CFOs, same data, same kind of points, but we added one thing, is we look at what percent of the CEO's comp, CFO's comp, is it, I was saying it clearly, how much of the, what's the percent of the CFO to CEO comp? And there's an interesting question here. If you look at it in terms of salary, it's like 74%. CFO's salary is at 74% of CFO. Now, these are pretty active CFOs. I know people who say they're a CFO, but they're really a controller. So you'll see that relationship be 60 or 50%. Or you'll see really it's a CFO, COO, and you'll see 85%. You see some ranges based on, you could call it a CFO, but reality is it's different. And you tend not to see it closer than 85%. There are exceptions to everything, but so you start to see that in terms of the relationship. It's a little bit different when you get to total comp, bonuses and equity, because the CEOs make a lot more. But overall, it's around 60%. So what we find is that the CFO salaries tend to be 40 to 60%. And LTI tends to be 1 to 2%, not 2 to 3%. Total direct comp, rather than 1 to 3%, is a 0.5% to 1% of revenues. And it tends to be around 60% total cash. So I'll give you some references, if you will, of a CFO to a CEO. Thought? Question? Reaction?
Well, you have it, looking ahead, you have this, the CFO is the second highest paid.
And
in some organizations, right, they list the top five, if they still do that.
Right.
It's the sales person, somebody in sales is included in the five.
Well, the next slide is actually ahead of sales.
I know, but it's not included in the five based on your...
It's not. It's interesting. I agree with you. I mean, I found it really, and partly because there is sometimes a COO, sometimes there is a head of manufacturing operations, which is critical, or somebody who is basically if they put sales at the stage of its development, early on, in an early stage company, head of sales usually gets their comp primarily tied to what revenues either they generate or their business generates. they're sort of linked to that. As they, there's a point in time where they shift from being that to being an executive. And they all of a sudden now they have, their comp ought to be tied into the company's profitability. Yeah, revenue growth is fine, but also about profits. Not just creating dollars, it's creating profitable dollars. And so you see the shift that occurs in a sales role. But it's interesting that I and I can't really explain why, maybe you can explain why a head of sales isn't always in the top five. In some places it's not.
I think it's because that role's getting fragmented. You know, you have a chief marketing officer that maybe has a certain skill set. You have sales, and then you, oftentimes you're now seeing customer success, which is about expansion. So I think what's happening is maybe if you used to spend $1 million with one guy, you might or person, you might now be spending $500,000 with two or three.
Yeah, that's a good point. Right.
Yeah. I've also seen in my last employer, head of sales was really coach. It was head of sales and marketing, but really sales. But there were a couple of out of a relatively small sales team. There were two reps. It was a incentive-based comp that had outsized earnings because they brought in significant revenue.
Yeah.
And to pay them and to pay the head of sales was problematic.
Right.
Because I've got some lower performers, I've got some significant performers from the standpoint of the sales pyramid. Because maybe the average yield for a company is $5 million. But when you look at the compensation, when you look at what the revenue generated by the sales team is, usually, you know, three quarters are well below that line, some approach it, and then you get a few people that are in the 10 to 20 million range.
Yeah.
And if I don't pay them, they go elsewhere, and it crowds out compensation for other people to some extent.
Yeah.
So there's only so much money to go around because I've got to generate the EBITDA to do a whole bunch of other things.
That's great. So I'm sensitive to our time. We got a lot of things to cover. I'm going to touch a little bit about board comp, and then I'll flip over to Susan talks about grants. So on page 8, there's a board comp. And it's broken out in terms of our same sort of sectors, if you will. But it's looking at retainers. At for this is an average company, $375 million in revenues. Pays its board $45,000 in retainers. Pays $1,000 to $1,500 a meeting. Generates about $10,000 in terms of income. They pay them. This is an interesting question. In this case, notice 33% is an option, 60% payments to restricted stock. We've seen boards comp radically shift from options to restricted shares. So I think very rarely now do we see board comp having options, unless it's a small company and all that. But most boards, and sometimes there's some restrictions around that in terms of guidelines. So they're trying to get away from tying management and the board together in the same kind of performance year, if you will, and to really let the board serve in governance and therefore be more independent, therefore think more longer term. So we have a number of clients who you can't sell your shares till you leave the board. And when you leave the board, then you can sell your shares. But and that, what's that trying to do? It's trying to make sure that we're not doing deals. You know, I'll scratch your back, you scratch my back kind of philosophy. That's a really important part in the whole discussion on board governance and has been for years, so nothing new there. And we look at the mix, basically, if you think about it, in terms of like, you know, it's roughly, we see the retainers, equity awards equal about once or two times the retainer. So if you pay somebody $50,000 in a retainer, you probably give $100,000 a year. Not always, but in some cases. And once again, it depends on a whole lot of things with our philosophy. But I want you to see some of this as a way of understanding what this is. And what is also interesting is in the net data analysis we look at, 22% of companies don't use equity in board compensation at all. It's all strictly cash.
Mm-hmm. That's so surprising.
It's 22%, so it's not a lot.
But
there's a statement.
22% is a fair amount.
And the statement is, I'm paying you. And what's really interesting about board comp, it's shifted from what I'll call transactions, which used to be only paid for board meetings, to now paying a retainer. So they said, I'm paying you away from a transaction, I'm paying you for a job. And that job is to help us govern and do this business well.
But then you're not aligned with shareholders.
you're not a primary shareholder, or that, but you said that's what your job is. And so, but I, you know, I'm not, I'm just trying to say what the reason that they those that, that 20% land there is they think that by providing equity to board, it undermines the long-term, it could undermine the long-term interest because it makes executives, I don't like this argument, but the argument is that it somehow puts you in collusion with the management, or it could.
So if a company asked you your advice on that matter, what would you say?
I would say, I would disagree with that statement I just said, because I do believe in the alignment. I've done this a lot, because I think this is really important. But I want conditions under board equity that's different from what the executives are in terms of access.
So one comment, one question.
Yeah.
Comment is that all of my boards and all the boards I've been on in the last all of 10 years requires you to hold, I think it's 3 times your annual cash up in your equity. It's just, so it's again a way of aligning.
Exactly.
But the question I have, because I have actually, even with all the companies that have approached me, I've never seen anyone who doesn't give equity.
Yeah.
I just haven't. So my question is,
it's minor.
When you look at that 22%, I mean, what kinds of companies are there? Is there some sort of a subset or a trend or something? Because you're in retail. I'm in consumer products and industrial.
I've been on board since 98.
Yeah,
I've never seen
so we...
that.
We kind of cover the waterfront.
It's a good question, and you know, I don't know I didn't really study that. I just thought it was interesting,
curious.
The data point. It's a fairly minor point, but I think it's a shrinking minor point because I think more people are.
Okay.
We're doing with mutual companies and you know, cooperatives that are all using equity in some sort or another. So I do think it's an area that is sort of, you know, but there's you know, there are people who believe all kinds of things. all I can say is that would I be attracted to them? Would they be attracted to me? Probably not. But you know, so all they're doing is what it is.
But I can't even. I don't even think ISS would approve of that.
Right.
Because ISS requires.
It requires equity.
Requires equity and a certain.
So let's
they actually indicate
but,
a vote against.
Yeah, right.
Yes.
I know.
If
I know.
The equity is not of a certain.
Right.
Size.
And
right.
If the board isn't holding that
exactly.
certain percent of
exactly.
that equity.
So let's not bother with it. Let's talk
it's
about other.
Yeah.
It is. Let's talk about other trends.
Use a British term on gobsmacked.
So we're on page 9, and the next couple of pages was a survey we conducted with our, we have part of a national network, where we asked companies to answer some questions around trends, around what they were doing with salaries, bonuses, equity. So this page here is by employee group or level of job. What did they actually budget or pay for merit increases? So this doesn't include, say, adjustments for promotions or anything that. And certainly this is a number we've been paying attention to because of the fact that we thought that maybe with the tax cut there might be some more spending going on. But it's not showing up in merit. Let's just say it's not performance-based if it is happening. It's probably more to be competitive here. So we can see that with, you know, we're seeing this movement 3 to 3.2% on average. But, you know, in certain industries, it varies quite a bit. Like I have a little nonprofits, and some of them are really way down in the 2.4 range. And then there's certain industries where we would see these numbers or more, a little bit more budgeted for merit. And you can see, too, going across by group that, you know, we're actually seeing on this, the CEO is going down slightly. Everyone is getting, they're offering increases every 12 months. And same with the executives, but the non-execs are staying the same. So
that bothers me that the execs are sitting up there 3-5.
All right. But it's interesting is that in the past, before we've done this thing for, I don't know, 15 years, it's been there was a time when executives made more, maybe 0.5% or 1% more, and then they were the same across the board, and we're starting to see a kick up among executives.
Well, all that does is feed a lot of unrest. It's already
out
there.
It does.
Yeah, and then
it
all the percentages built off of that.
It's
ridiculous for that amount of money in each person's pocket.
It does. And then you add bonuses on top of that. Yeah.
It's funny to some of the process that we experience, which is when the senior team is, the merit is up, is put in, do they not sort of equal out when you look at the total? So they sort of have their own little way that they look at that. So it's sometimes separate, and that's why it's a little bit high. What are you finding in your organizations? Is it 3?
For merit increases.
Is it more? Is it less?
3%.
It's been 3 for 100 years.
60 years at least, it seems.
Not my career, but
yeah. I've been seeing it go a lot higher than 3.
Yeah.
Right. 5 range, particularly at the lower end of the organization. We attribute most of that. There's a need to do it because of the competitiveness at the lower end of the employee range. The folks aren't out there to hire. They're expecting more money to retain them. We're having to pay more.
Yeah, and again, merit versus other increases. We were talking a little bit about millennials, too, whether there's an expectation that they're looking at a bigger budget. They anticipate a bigger budget as they start in their career and move up.
So, question, in the groups that I talk about, the millennials are keeping, retaining people, it seems that we seem to get out of the salary discussion and we seem to go to the environment, the perks, the other stuff discussion. Is that a real trend or is that just...
That's the lower right-hand quadrant of our little grid. That's a big deal. In fact, there's a company that I know that is building a fascinating platform for creating communities inside organizations. So you'll hear about meetings that are happening or yoga classes or events or beer things that are happening, and you go to different offices, you can connect with them. So there's a whole technology that's being built to try to create a sense of community, because they realized something very, very simple, that the retention of, if you have a good friend at work, if you have a lot of good friends at work, your ability to, your probability of leaving drops dramatically. So it serves to retain people, which makes it less expensive for you to retain somebody. You don't have to pay for them because they have created a community of friends, and they don't want to leave their friends. And their friends are somebody who depend upon me, or I depend upon them. And you create that kind of thing. And how do you do that in a culture is a competitive advantage, frankly. It's a really competitive advantage.
So it's 5 of 6, and I want to just see if people want to stay longer than 6.
Keep going.
All right, go ahead.
Okay. All right, on page 10, we're looking at, we asked for what the bonus percentages are. This is percent of base salary for the different groups. Target, so what we wanted to look at was not only between groups, but target versus actual payouts. Sometimes we just see a lot of data where... the payouts are much lower than the targets. And here we're seeing more groups where they are above, such as senior individual contributors. The actual payout is higher. But we noticed for all other executives, it went down a little bit. And chief executives are right at the same mark. Non-exempt employees, where again, prevalence varies, again, based on culture, could be industry, how far in the organization you have bonuses, but for non-exempt employees, seeing that go up, possibly that is a way to attract that group that can be very hard to find. Non-exempt, does have such a large, diverse group of employees, when you look at nurses versus manual workers to, certain IT professionals and so on. It's such a large group on the town.
Can you comment on the, particularly at the top of the organizations, the percentage
that you see being single metric versus balanced scorecard, single metric largely yeah. being EBITDA or net profit
yeah.
or something?
No, interesting. So we like this balanced scorecard, so most likely if you've worked with us, we most likely have seen it. And we like it because it has balanced measures. Maybe not balanced like it was originally designed with the, you know, the four specific quadrants that were supposed to be in there. But and we like it because it's weighted. And so then that way organizations are really focused on balance, not sacrificing one result for another. So we do like that. So in terms of what we see is thinking about in the public companies, how they describe, they have to now describe a lot of times, and they go into great detail, especially for executives, what their plans are, what their measures are, and of course, investment is going to be different than others. So I think I would say that it's becoming, seeing it more, I mean, observation-wise, I don't know if we don't have data on that.
Really, I mean, I think the typical, you know, revenue growth, some sort of profit metric,
yep.
whether it be EBITDA or a margin or operating margin or operating profit, whatever, and then you look at things. Then there's usually some sort of strategic measure that are in place. It could be corporate-wide, or it could be a product launch. It could be, you know, acquiring 10 new customers. Or, you know, it could be getting kind of tactical at that point in time. But you'll see some balance of those kinds of things. And we often see... whereas in some large companies, we'll see metrics that relate to some sort of employee engagement kind of metrics or things of that nature, or retention or something that feeds on it. The shift for us in measures is to see it away from sort of being this market this basket of things where we pick, to see it as a food chain. Okay, you want to be profitable. You want to grow your profitability? Well, how do you grow your profitability? What are the things you got to increase and decrease to get profitable? And then you sort of work backwards. Well, you want to grow revenues? Well, how do you grow revenues? Well, you need customers. You know, sort of look at it as a food chain and then step back and look at your sort of heuristic, if you will, and say, these are the most critical ones, and it's 3 to 5, and we're done. And so, and then you spend the goal setting is the hard part. You need a range and all that good stuff. So, to Susan's point, there's no studies that we've seen. We've seen things that talk about their list of measures, but we often find the most important is the discussion of why that measure and how we're going to do it, and make sure it, to Susan's point, optimizes and balances what you're trying to accomplish.
How about the experience here? How many of you use?
We all use.
Or have seen them.
I ran compensation for global services at PTC, and we definitely had a balanced scorecard.
Yeah.
So what I've been seeing is a teeny bit different, new ones. At the CEO level, CEO and CFO tends to be very numeric,
right.
Revenue, profit, cash flow.
Like.
And I use those three measures because most of them are those three measures. Below the CEO and the CFO, tend to get the balance scorecard.
Mm-hmm.
And the sort of the rest of the other of the three of the top five, some go in box A, some go in box B.
Mm-hmm.
But basically below the top five, it's uniformly a balance scorecard approach. At least that's what I've seen.
Well, the principle is line of sight. The measures that you can't affect, you want people to be weighted. But then there's a problem where you take it down to the operating floor level, and it's so complicated to measure all that stuff and to get it all done that itself will kill you. So you have to find what's the optimal point around number of measures, type of measures, and ways to be able to track them and be, you know, at what point in time you really says it's really frankly more cost effective and more appropriate for us to use a group metric rather than individual metrics. Because we want people to collaborate at that level. And the rest of the stuff that people do individually will handle in that lower right-hand box. You know, the recognition, the support, the thank yous, the attaboy, and maybe special bonuses.
All right, so on page 11, long-term incentive. So we talked about that quite a bit when we were talking about CEOs and CFOs. This was didn't have a CEO in it. But in terms of prevalence, seeing that becoming a more prominent vehicle in companies, even private companies. So the use of some of the things we have to untangle, though, is whether they're talking about performance base. Is it really a long-term incentive, or is it a deferred compensation program where they're just targeting, you know, we'll give you something that either mimics or is equity in a firm, so you can have ownership by a certain amount of ownership by a certain number of years.
Can I ask a question on that? Because, again, all my companies have LTIs, in addition to equity, I should say. And all of them are, they're not balanced scorecards. They're all numeric.
Yeah.
Okay. That's right.
And then some of them may look at, say, relative, like might be looking at TSR, relative TSR, or relative measures. You might see that. But it is hard to do more than one measure. We find it hard for them to identify.
I'm not seeing a lot of TSR.
Yeah. So our
as a metric.
Our thinking is that your bonus plan is like is a P&L orientated. Your equity award is a balance sheet oriented.
Right.
And so it's about what the enterprise does. So if you get an extra 1,000 units or shares, it's because what you did to help build value for the company. It may not affect our business today, but in 2 years, 3 years, 5 years, it does, and that's why you get this 1,000 shares extra over what we're doing. And it creates an opportunity to reward that kind of thinking and those kinds of behaviors, rather than, you really managed your budget, you came out on time, and all that kind of stuff. That's your P&L, that's your bonus.
But Elaine's point is interesting, because I haven't really thought about it. You said that. I mean, I used to see a lot of TSR.
I did too. It was a big
push.
Yeah.
And I'm seeing less now.
Yes,
exactly. You guys are seeing
TSR?
Yeah.
Because it doesn't, most of the research is showing it has no bearing in terms of actual results of companies.
It's good reason then not to see
it.
We
did study of our client, and we said, what are the measures?
Does everyone know what TSR is?
I don't.
Yeah, so you may
want to
explain
TSR. I mean, it's total shareholder return. So it's looking at what the share price and dividends and other kinds of things have happened. That says what's the difference of the shareholder value over from one point in time to 3 years later. But it's interesting is that it's not necessarily more profitable or higher growth companies. It's kind of part of the reason is that sometimes share price is a function of stock price, which is independent of your business, and also to do with whatever kind of buyback provisions you kind of go after with your new windfall you got from the Trump tax bill. You know, there's a lot of things that happen in there that's changing some of those TSR results that have nothing to do with what you did as a business.
Yeah.
For a lot of years, it was sort of the golden child of the metrics.
You had to report it,
and that's all everybody focused on.
Yeah, people are sort of standing up to the ISS.
It's a wonderful thing.
Well, Ellen, when you talked about a number of months ago about kind of the landscape and trying to land the board position, and you talked about, I think what stuck in my mind is, what is it? Almost half of the old S&P 500 from 20 years ago are no longer public companies, or some major, it's a big number. The world is awash with cash from a private equity standpoint, and that's its own unique world. So it's interesting where things are going now. We're looking at some big IPOs potentially this year, with a few of them at least that they're getting a lot of ink. But the transactions going back and forth between companies and the companies that continue to try to, that are looking for the exit to go private.
Well, I think the point, if I remember, because it was about 18 months ago or so that I did that thing, maybe it was almost a year ago, but basically what I was talking about was the statistics are now, and I wish I could remember exactly what they are, but the number of public companies has dropped tremendously. And the number of board seats on any existing board has been dropping because boards have been shrinking. So therefore, the number of public company director slots is
Interesting.
And I can't remember the exact statistics, but it's down significantly. And that was the conversation we were having.
Yeah, and my observation, this is really, this is great stuff. The interesting thing is, as more companies are private, what are things looking like from the standpoint of compensation packages,
right,
and retention at all levels?
Right.
I think the question came up a little bit ago, and particularly in terms of kind of what the portfolio and private equity folks,
right,
are doing, because is this a good proxy for the entire market, or is it, this is what's going on in the public company space, but with the private company space, it's kind of all over the map, or it's a very, very narrow,
yeah,
focus in terms of what does compensation look like and incentives look like. And I don't know. That's kind of the interesting question in my mind.
One thing I know is that if you're working with a particular private equity firm, they have their methodology on how they structure compensation, and it could be different than somebody else. So within a portfolio company, it's the same model. But if you look across portfolios and cross companies, there is no pattern, and the company's gone private. It's crazy, and people really need good comp consultants to help figure all that out.
You brought cards, right?
and speaking of that, for smaller companies too, for startups, they're not going to be really looking at percent of salary. They're going,
right,
to be looking at percent of shares that they're giving out of the ownership piece, and so that is different than how this is looking at. So we're thinking that these are not representing those smaller startup companies. And then the last thing on this particular survey trend was page 12, and this was that other one of those other boxes. What did you call it, Tom? The lower
right hand corner.
Lower.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. So these are the more and some of the things we were talking about, the more unusual things like the social network was not on here, but these are 20 different programs, from spot awards, retention bonuses, to different tools or wellness programs, concierge, maybe even some expansion of long-term incentives is also listed there. So there's a couple of columns here in terms of what people responded, what they currently use versus ones they use only for hot jobs, and then what they were considering to add in 2019 and what they may be discontinuing. So we're finding that there, you know, there's certain trends around, you see in the green around what is being used most commonly, certainly formal recognition programs. That is something that you find in most organizations. But what are the things that aren't being used or people are thinking about using that might actually be attractive to the workforce that you have that is different, that could be a competitive advantage to attract and retain people. But these are always, sometimes people overlook these particular programs and they can really add a lot of value. Yeah.
Susan, I'm struck by the very last row, what appears to me very modest use of long-term incentives.
Yeah, expanding use.
Could you comment on that?
And I think that what we meant there was those weren't annual awards. Those were like, you know, a special award, like a recognition type,
yeah,
piece.
And they're expanding the use of them. They may have them in place, so kind of like we give it to our executives and our management, but we don't do it for our rank and file. We will look at putting special equity awards to rank and file teams who do a particularly fabulous job this year, kind of thing. So, but I think Dr. Susan's point is that a lot of this is about the where do you get competitive advantage, where do you get the best bang for your bucks, you know, what fits your philosophy and culture, and the things that really resonate. And I always look at some, when people look at these numbers, well, only 8% do that. I says, you know, but you know what? They have competitive advantage and you don't. So always look at the people, always look at the places where people are not doing things and saying, hey, if I try to do everything like everybody else is doing, you don't have any competitive advantage because you're doing the same thing everybody else is doing. If you do something different and it works, then it could create
competitive advantage for you. You have a question?
So could I, there's a hot button on here for me.
Yeah.
And it's training, and I mentioned this, management training, I mentioned this when I have a chance to stand in front of some students. There's Jack on here for that. If you talk about,
right.
Let's see, here's the way it goes, your bottom right,
right.
is worthless
yeah.
if you got a bad supervisor in the middle of that and he's driving people off.
You got it.
Right?
Yep.
So where is the investment in management training? If you go to GE,
mm-hmm.
if you go to some of these other firms,
right.
you're going to come out of there being a great supervisor,
right.
good leadership development.
Right.
But other companies, particularly in the startup and
right.
the low end,
right.
they don't invest in that.
Right.
And yet, you know, a person might not leave for $5,000.
Right.
They will if they've got a bad supervisor.
Yep.
$5,000 difference
yep.
is what I meant.
Yep.
Right. So I think that they're missing it here, and I'm just request to you that when you're out there preaching to
yeah.
people that they start doing this.
Yeah.
Yeah,
new
training.
Yeah, absolutely.
The technology around training now is amazing, where you can offer, for example, small companies, they can buy like an ADP payroll package that includes training, online training.
And I'm talking about the hot button things.
Yeah.
Gender-based. You
yeah.
know, you do not like have a conversation with a person of the opposite sex without a witness in the room. If you're doing a, it doesn't matter which way,
yeah,
if you're doing
Michael
a corrections or a workforce performance.
Yeah.
And there's a number of these things that people don't know about.
Right, I know, exactly.
And they're not getting it in the classroom out of a book.
Right, exactly.
And so to that point, I was wondering what addressing turnover issues were, because I was hoping that was addressing lousy management.
And therefore, going back to Tom's competitive advantage,
right.
if you've got a stable workforce
right.
that has that institutional knowledge you're talking about, you're sure they're going to have maybe, what is the average turnover is 20%?
Mm-hmm. Go like that.
But if you've got 40% or something, you've got
yeah.
an issue going on.
Right.
You need to get in front of it.
You do.
And you won't get your competitive advantage.
And it costs you a fortune. So, yeah.
So is that what you mean by addressing turnover issues? I wasn't sure what that meant.
It was a point in a survey, so it wasn't necessarily a big description about it. And so I find it interesting, some people just don't notice that. But some organizations, like we were asking Todd too, if people were really concerned, they were getting ready to go through a fairly serious time and they wanted to retain kind of a core group. They looked at the top 50 people and they were really worried about that. So what we did is did an analysis of everything that people participate in, have received, or whatever. They did a relocation, did they do a deal at all that sort of, do they have equity, do they have extra health insurance, do they have extra life insurance, do they have dependent care, blah, 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 blah. Principle's this. Remember the thing about banking? If you just have a checking account, your probability of leaving the bank is like 80 or 90% within a year. But if you have a checking account and a savings account and a lockbox and a safe deposit box and an equity loan and a blah, 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 your chances of leaving, regardless of how much you get abused by the acquisition of that bank, you'll stay with that bank.
That's true.
And it's that principle that says, if we can have so many hooks in you that you don't want to leave your business because we've taken care of we've got top 29 plans in place for your kids, we've got all that stuff.
It embeds
you into this whole thing.
Yes.
But it goes back to, and I'll leave it the last few minutes, the last two points, the last two pages really about philosophy, and it's kind of where it evolves over time, and what's important from a compensation point of view. So you've seen, you know, charts like this about companies emerging grow, you know, investing grow, personalizing. There's a point in time where the thing that made you successful is now your albatross. And so the challenge is to shift, when you begin to recognize that things are shifting in your business because you are now at a maturity that things need to change. And so the page 14 takes those five different sort of growth stages and talks about what's their characteristic and what's the kind of corollary compensation philosophy at a fairly high level. Philosophy, not specific programs, about what you look at. And you can see, so you start with salary, just enough salaries and no bonus, and it's all about stock, all about the future. Then you've grown up a bit and you've proved your concept, and so you give a bonus if you can afford it, and you do some targeted, thoughtful kind of equity, not just throw everything at them. Then you move to salary structures and career paths, and to the point you're saying, people start to pay attention to
how do we provide a way that recognizes people as they grow? How do we look at, we're now different locations, we're different places, we need multiple structures and philosophies, we different, you know, we gotta do things differently, blah, blah, blah. And then you are going to a stage where you kind of reinvent yourself. We got to rethink all that. So companies go through these philosophies, and compensation is just a tool to help you accomplish what you want to do. It's that simple. And so our job today was to share some tools and thoughts and realize that you're the case study.
That's great. Thank you very much,
Tom and Susan. Thank you.